It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There may be between 1.5 and 15 million fungal species, with 5 million, give or take, a reasonable compromise. But as mycologist Keith Seifert notes, only about 140,000 are cataloged and named. We will learn why the future is fungal. It's ripe for a bumper sticker. Join in on fungi species, on yeasts, mushrooms, and here's a crowd pleaser, mold-based cheeses. 800-642-1234. Fungus scientist Keith Seifert is an adjunct researcher professor at Carleton University in Ontario, Canada. His new book is called The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi, Exploring the Microscopic World in Our Forests, Homes, and Bodies. Keith, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. Well, let's start with a bit of pronunciation and terminology. You say fungi, some say fungi. What's the difference?
Yeah, there's a bit of a cultural thing, I think. The people at Oxford say it one way and the people at Cambridge say it another way. But the Oxford people tend to be, in the Oxford English Dictionary, they go with both pronunciations. So both are considered correct according to that source anyway. And I just say fungi because my first professor, who I was just visiting yesterday, actually has always said it that way. And so it just sunk into my brain that way.
Talk to us a little bit about the names. Didn't you get to name discovered fungi after like Homer Simpson or SpongeBob or something?
Why did SpongeBob? That was an American mycologist.
You can't claim SpongeBob, but you can claim Homer Simpson.
He had children, but so he knew all about SpongeBob. But yeah, we named the new species that we find, and as you said in your prologue there, there's a lot of new species out there to name. So it's a fun thing to do. If you use your imagination, you can come up with interesting names for fungi. I did name a fungus after Homer Simpson, and that was really just an homage to him. I wanted to name fungi after the whole family one by one, but I never got around to that.
You call mycology a dark art. Why is studying fungi a dark art?
I think that people have a very particular attitude towards fungi, and there's a lot of jokes about mushrooms and being kept in the dark and the things that some mushrooms grow on. And so people tend to look at them in kind of a negative way. But at the same time, because so many of them are hidden, they're out of our view and we don't see them, there does seem to be a bit of an impression maybe that there's some kind of mystical process involved in detecting them. It does take a bit of technology sometimes, although when you learn what to look for, then you see them everywhere.
I love how you call fungi the connective tissue of life. And we're going to be able to make those connections here. But fungi is now considered its own kingdom. And when you started studying fungi, it was considered part of the plant kingdom. How are fungi distinct from plants?
They don't really have a lot to do in common with plants. The whole body design is different. Their biochemistry is different. I think that they were included, they were considered primitive plants. And some plants like ferns and mosses do reproduce using spores, which is really what fungi specialize in, is making spores. But that's about where the similarity ends. But I think from the animal perspective, we kind of thought they sit still, they grow and they produce spores, so they're not like us, therefore they're all the same. And once people studied fungi in a more serious way, in a more scientific way, they could see that there was really not a lot in common with plants in that way. As we've seen in the last couple of decades, they actually are more closely related to animals than they are to plants.
It's just so fascinating that what I really love about the book is you really uncover their secret lives that they have, because we just go about our business and either we think that they're a little bit gross or that we just don't even realize they're there. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is going on around us that we're not aware of with fungi?
Well, because we don't see them, we tend not to think about them, but they do a lot of things both in nature and in the human world. And the book is really about their interaction with the human world. So they do good things. And one of those good things is a process we call symbiosis, which is when two organisms grow together and assist each other. That's the most more altruistic view of looking at it, is that it's a win-win situation for them. And the classic example there is lichens, where you've got fungi and algae growing together. And together, these lichens can live for hundreds of years apart. They either don't live at all or they don't live so long. But this symbiosis also sort of slides into more ambiguous relationships where one organism is really benefiting more than the others. And we call that at the far end a parasitic relationship. So you've got a parasite that needs to grow inside of a host. And there are fungi that are like that with humans and also with plants.
We're talking about the microscopic world of fungi with mycologist Keith Seifert, author of the new book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Keith, I just loved how you called fungi such great collaborators when you talk about the symbiosis. And that Arctic lichen, it was found to be 4,500 years old. How is that possible?
It just grows really slow. So they started, I think they grow less than a millimeter a year. So they just kind of sit there. And the fungus and the alga, the fungus protects the alga that's inside. So they can just kind of hunker down. And whenever it gets warm or wet enough, they kind of wake up and they grow a little bit. So it's a little bit like hibernation, if you want to think of it in that way. And it just keeps spreading. And they know the age because they know how fast these particular lichens grow. So they can go back and look at historical photographs of the same place, and they can see how big that lichen was at that time. Hmm. And they can see how big it is now, and then they can calculate backwards how old it is.
And I learned that lichens, you say, are still used for monitoring air pollution around cities. How does that work?
Some lichens are very sensitive to heavy metals like that come out of... I grew up in a mining community in Northern Ontario, so this was a big deal, actually, in the city I grew up in, which is Sudbury, because we had a nickel mine, also copper mine there. And so there was a lot of air pollution at that time, and they were trying to mitigate the air pollution. So one way they could monitor it without having to do all of the expensive chemical tests was by hiring some summer students and teaching them how to identify lichens. And they could go out and find the lichens that are sensitive to air pollution start to grow again when the air pollution starts to decline. And some species are known to be quite tolerant. So when I grew up, all the lichens I would have seen around the rocks around the house would have been tolerant to air pollution. So once you learn the difference between the two, then you can use that as a bioindicator.
Fungus scientist Keith Seifert is taking us on a tour of the millions of fungal species in nature. They're critical components of our heritage and among our closest relatives. Join in on how fungal connections shape how we live, what you've wondered about mold spores around you. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mycologists guard a secret. Keith Seifert writes. Fungi are the connective tissue of life, but there's a problem, he says. We have such an inbred revulsion toward fungi that there is an adjective for it. We're mycophobic. Join in with questions about what's growing in the fridge, the spores we inhale, the dandruff yeasts covering our skin. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi, and Keith Seifert stays with us. Let's take a call now. Angie is with us in Madison. Hi, Angie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. So I am a paleoecologist, so I study, ecosystem change in the past, and specifically I'm interested in the extinction of large herbivores like mammoths and mastodons. And one of the tools that we use are fungal spores in sediment records that are generally associated with these large herbivore dung piles. And I'm really curious to get the opinion of Dr. Seifert to see, what he thinks about paleomycology and using, using fungi in this way and how we're applying it and if he's familiar with it.
Angie, thank you. Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, I've never seen any of these fossils myself, so my knowledge is from talking with other people and reading papers and editing papers. It's a fascinating thing. And I think that now people are becoming increasingly aware of these odd shapes that they see in their fossils, that they might be fungi. So there's been a lot in the news, in the science news in the last few years about some very ancient fungi. So it's really helpful to have that kind of information to compare with the calculations they make using DNA sequences for the ages of species or the ages of fungal groups. And another aspect of that is that there are fossil roots of plants that are now shown to have the fungal symbionts inside, and that helps us trace back the origin of land plants when life left the ocean and crawled onto land.
Oh, that's fascinating. Angie, thank you so much. And as you talk about, fungi on dung piles from prehistoric times, in the book you talk about how fungi don't discriminate between what is in your refrigerator or what might be in the compost pile. Can you kind of explain how that waste turns into food?
Well, I think I probably use a phrase like decay is in the eye of the beholder or rot is in the eye of the and people who, I like just about any kind of food, but I can remember being a kid and my parents putting something like sauerkraut, which is not a fungal fermented product, but, putting that in front of a kid and expecting them to eat it. And you think, oh my God, what are they giving me? But there are lots of fungal foods that are part of Asian culture in particular, but also other cultures. And so you mentioned earlier in the broadcast, the mold fermented cheeses. So that's the blue cheeses and the white cheeses like Camembert and Brie. So their principal fermentation organism is a fungus, is a mold. There's other microbes in there too, bacteria. So we do eat these things and we enjoy them. But if you look at a compost pile, for example, in your kitchen, if you have a compost bucket, there's all these molds that are growing in there and you wouldn't want to eat that. So one of the tricky things about fermented foods is deciding not just if it's palatable, but whether it's safe. And that's one reason we say not to eat molded cheese. So cheese that's not supposed to go moldy that goes moldy, it's not a good idea to eat it because it may not be safe. There may be toxins that are produced. But the fungi that are supposed to be growing on cheese, like the blue cheese fungus, that doesn't make toxins when it grows in dairy products. So it's very much a yin and yang kind of situation. You really want to be sure that whatever it is that's growing on what you may consider food is actually safe, or if it's dangerous, then it's considered rot.
What
decay.
What if you trim off that visible moldy piece? Can you eat it then, or what has happened to that particular cheese?
I think the problem is if you don't know what the fungus is, then you don't know what the toxins might be. And so in general, I advise people not to eat moldy food. And as painful as that sometimes is, especially if you have a really expensive and exquisite cheese sitting in the fridge, you really don't want to throw it away. But if you hold it up at a certain light, you can see the spores of the fungus that's spoiling the cheese, but you can also see kind of a change in the luster or the texture of the cheese around the spores. And that tells you that the fungus is growing beyond where the spores are and you can't really see where it ends. So we really advise people not to eat moldy food unless it's supposed to be moldy.
Keith Seifert with us, adjunct research professor at Carleton University in Canada, as we talk about the world of fungi. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. I think your guest just sort of hinted at answering one of my interests, and that is, as I understand it, yeast is a fungi that reproduces asexually by budding. And in a state like Wisconsin, which is a beer brewing state, to some extent, a wine growing state, I mean, much more limited than elsewhere in the USA, but definitely cheese. Does your guest classify yeast as one of the most economically profoundly important for an economy like Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like him to emphasize the fact that an awful lot of what we get, including sauerkraut and kimchi, ferments, and the role of fermentation in our world is just profound.
Well, Rich, thank you for that. Keith, take us into the world of yeasts.
Sure, Rich. That's a very leading question. And one of the, you've given me some new information. I didn't know there was wine made in Wisconsin. So the next time I'm there, I'm going to have to check that out. But yeah, yeasts are awesome. And I do a calculation in the book that estimates that there's 80 million times more yeast than there are stars in the Milky Way, or that there's 4 billion times more yeast cells at any one time on the planet than there are people. And there is a line of thought that yeast fermented products were very critical in the development of human civilization. We tend to think of cities having grown up around agriculture to support agriculture, but some people think that the main reason people wanted agriculture was so they can make beer and bread. So it definitely is a huge part of the economy. And there's some estimates by some economists that the yeast economy, that the alcohol-based economy, is 10% of the world economy. So this is a huge thing, not for just for Wisconsin, but evidently just for also it is in Wisconsin and some of the other states. I think of Vermont with all of its cheese and so on. It's a huge industry.
Similar segue, I suppose, but I learned about dandruff yeasts. You really allowed us inside the coating over our skin. Can you explain what dandruff yeasts are?
Sure, dandruff yeasts grow on just about everybody. So I think 7 billion people estimated have dandruff yeasts growing on them. And there are different kinds of yeasts. It's different species than what's used for brewing alcohol. They're Basidiomycetes, so they're more closely related to mushrooms. And they form a coating over our skin, and we're not entirely sure what the positive part of it is. So they're symbionts, and we think that they're generally helping with the moisturizing of the skin and keeping the bacteria from attacking through the skin. But if they get to goopy. If they make too big a coating over the skin, too thick a coating, then the skin cells fall off. And we shed about 30 or 40,000 skin cells per day. So that's a lot of skin cells that fall off. And that's mostly, it would be falling off anyway because the skin is always growing, but it also has the benefit of keeping the yeast dandruff cells under control.
At bay. Biology professor Keith Seifert focuses his research on mycology or fungus research, interpreting the meaning of the world from the behavior of fungi. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn why we must rethink our relationship with fungi. Mycologist Keith Seifert explains in his new book how fungi are stereotyped as agents of decay, disease, rot, and mold, and we assume they spoil all that is clean and pristine. But Keith lays out why that couldn't be further from the truth, and introducing us to the millions of fungi species on our planet and why they are so indispensable to the life cycle. Join in, 800-642-1234. The book is called The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi, and Carleton University adjunct research professor in the Department of Biology, Keith Seifert, stays with us. Let's go to Kate in Manitowish Waters. Kate, hi. Hi, Kate. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Hi. Would you go
ahead?
Can you hear me? Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah. My question is, the area that I live in, Wisconsin, is plagued with blastomycosis. And I was wondering what breakthroughs in research on finding out what causes blastomycosis, where the hosts are, and what's being done to make sure people are diagnosed properly.
Kate, thank you. And Keith, can you give us some context about blastomycosis?
I can give you a little bit. It's really not my area of expertise, but so blasto is a fungal pathogen. I think it's in soil. Most of these lung pathogens are in soil, and that gets contaminated either with bird feces or bat feces. So they tend to show up in people's attics, and they tend to be quite isolated geographically, some of them anyway. So I think blasto is one of those that's fairly well known in the American Midwest. Now, we've had a problem with antifungal antibiotics in the last while because fungi are more closely related to people or to animals than they are to plants. When we use things that are toxic to fungi, they are often kind of toxic also to people. So they tend to be really tough drugs to be used on people. And so I don't think a lot has changed recently in the treatment of blastomycosis. The diagnosis would have improved because now we can use DNA-based methods instead of microscopic methods. These diseases are very difficult to diagnose because they look so much like tuberculosis and other lung diseases that are not caused by fungi, and those diseases tend to be more common. So because the fungal diseases are relatively rare, they're often misdiagnosed. But the DNA testing should allow the blastomycosis to be detected a lot more quickly in the clinic, which would allow people to be treated with appropriate drugs, if not very kind drugs, more efficiently also.
You mentioned respiratory, and, you know, every day we're inhaling airborne spores and, you know, indoor air mold. What should we be aware of? Because it's all around us.
Sure. That's where this whole question of balance comes into our relationship with these organisms, because there are often thousands of spores per square yard in a, if you're walking around in a forest or something like that, and your lungs, our lungs, are more or less designed to expel them. So if they do happen to get breathed in and they go get down into the alveoli of the lungs, the whole mucus system, if you want to think of it, it's not the most pleasant thing to think about, but and sneezing and coughing and spitting and all of that, all of that is kind of designed to expel these undesirable microbes from inside our body. And so we humans evolved on a planet that was covered with mold. So we've evolved the systems to deal with it usually, but some people are very sensitive to mold spores. They can have elicit a allergic or asthma reaction. For those people, it is more serious. And then sometimes we get a very heavy concentration of spores of a particular species. In the book, I talk a little bit about Aspergillus fumigatus, which is can be fatal, and it tends to show up in people who are immunocompromised and in hospitals. And that's the other aspect of this, is if a person has a weakened immune system for some reason, either because of something like AIDS or because they have had an organ transplant and are taking immunosuppressant drugs, then they can be more susceptible to fungal disease.
Well, in the spirit of striking that balance, what can we do to limit mold growth in our living spaces? And what are your thoughts on using bleach?
We don't like bleach because bleach dries and makes crystals that can become airborne and then are just as noxious or even more noxious than the fungal spores. But there are products that you can buy that are said to be anti-mold. So if you see mold colonies on your walls or whatever, then people are selling something that can be used to treat that. In my house, when I find colonies of mold I want to get rid of, I use either hydrogen peroxide or rubbing alcohol. But mostly in people's houses, it comes down to hygiene and simple things like taking, especially in the summer, taking the compost bucket out every day and dumping it outside, you know, not keeping it around in your kitchen for a week. Vacuuming, if you don't have a special HEPA filter on your vacuum cleaner, vacuuming will send spores back up into the air, kind of shoots out the back of the vacuum, but not all of them. So you'll get rid of most of the spores that way. And really what you want to do is, especially under the bed and the carpets, or if I had a choice, I do have carpets in my house. If I had a choice, I would get rid of them and not have carpets, because they really do grab a lot of dirt. And if they get wet, then they can support some fungal growth. But for most people, it's just basic hygiene and kind of common sense of getting the moldy stuff out of the house when you find it.
We're talking about the microscopic world of fungi with mycologist Keith Seifert, author of the new book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I thought you were going to go to the vacuum cleaner experiment you did, which was really interesting. So you take a scoop of what's been sucked up into your vacuum cleaner and you check it out under the microscope. What did you learn?
Well, we looked at it under the microscope, but then we also looked at the DNA. So in my house, which is not entirely a typical house because it's a log house, but nevertheless, it's a relatively typical house for Canada or your part of the U.S., we found 600 fungal species based on the DNA in the house. But that would also include things that are blowing through the window and so on. So it's not as frightening as it appears. It's a kind of a head scratcher. You start thinking, well, where are all these fungi coming from? And some of them would be living here, growing on the in the house dust and so on, and some would have just come in. We had an interesting time trying to figure out, there's a group of fungi called endophytes that grow in plant needles, plant leaves rather, and conifer needles. And we were seeing these conifer needle endophytes in the house, and I couldn't figure out why would these be coming in the house? They live inside needles. And then one day I was going through the photographs, and there was a photo of a Christmas tree. And I realized that, the needles were falling off. They were being picked up by the vacuum cleaner, and then they got into our sample. So it wasn't really an indoor fungus, but it was a fungus we brought indoors.
Didn't you trace a spore to Japan as well?
Yeah, there were a few signals of Amanita, which is one of the poisonous mushrooms, but the species supposedly only grew in Japan, and I never really did figure that out. Every once in a while, I take that little piece of data and I run it again through the databases to see if a North American Amanita species has come up with the same sequence, but so far it still seems like it came from Japan.
Well, you brought up the word mushroom, and Lenny in Lake Geneva called and couldn't stay with us, but Lenny consumes a mushroom powder called OM in smoothies every morning, and Lenny is curious what you think of these powders.
I have no idea what that would be. There's something called chaga, which is so it's a wood decay mushroom, and people do grind that up and make tea out of it. I wonder if that's what it is. And then, or else there's another one called reishi, which is also wood decay fungus. And that one is reputed to have some health benefits as well. In traditional Oriental medicine, there is a lot of that kind of thing, of various fungi being used as kind of tonics. And there's not a lot of data, modern data, medical data, to support it or refute it. There's some research that goes on in the Orient about it, but here it tends to be more of a kind of folk remedy.
You tell us to, with wild mushrooms, to consume for the first time just a little bit of it, eat just a little, and also that mushroom pickers are taught to recognize Amanita. What does it do to us when you eat it?
Well, it makes some very complicated toxins, and it tends to make kind of soups of these toxins. It's not just one. So there'd be three or four similar toxins, and they are quite toxic to the kidneys in particular, and also to the liver. And they aren't destroyed by cooking. So you have these mushrooms, you cook them, you eat them, and you end up with these toxins in your liver. And it can make you feel quite sick for a few days, and then you think you've got better. And then you get really sick after a while. And then the only hope for you is really an organ transplant. So it is a serious thing. And mushroom hobbyists definitely do learn to recognize Amanita. They're common fungi. They're beautiful fungi. They're nice to look at, and they're important in the forest because they interact with the roots of trees, but one should not eat them. There are a few species that won't kill you. that's all you eat, but really they're hands-off things, and that's very important for people to learn if they want to eat wild mushrooms.
Canadian fungus scientist Keith Seifert, our guide to fungi, their biodegradation, their biochemistry, their symbiosis that make them such significant players in the environment. Still time to talk about fungi, what you're curious about in the proliferation of them. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Mycologist Keith Seifert is here, presents what he calls a fungal fantasy, helping us to envision what our lives and world might look like if we fully embraced our fungal friends. One, for instance, NASA is thinking about mycoarchitecture on Mars. The habitats of our first off-world colony may be grown and assembled from fungi. The new book is called The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi, and Keith Seifert stays with us. Keith, you mentioned the forest ecosystems, and, you know, fungi are critical partners in the ecosystem and the eventual, ability for forests to prosper or to fail. How do different fungi contribute to the forest ecosystem?
Yeah, forest is really as much a fungal ecosystem as it is plants. There's so many fungi there, playing so many different roles, that the plants are really, I don't want to say they're entirely dependent on the fungi. It's a mutualism. They need each other. So you look at a tree, I think there's a joke in the book that tree huggers are really fungus huggers. It's kind of true, because the fungi that are in the roots, they're called mycorrhizal fungi. So they're symbionts that they're responsible for gathering up a lot of the nutrients that the plants need. So their plants aren't using their roots to gather the nutrients. They're using their roots to attach to the fungus that's getting the nutrients for them. And in return, the plants are sending back down the sugars that they make in their leaves, and they go down and help feed the fungi that are around the roots. So most of the mushrooms that you see when you walk into a forest, most of them are that kind of mushroom. They're attached to the trees, and through the tree roots, they're attached to other fungi as well. So it's quite an ecosystem under the soil. And then the inside the leaves of the trees, I mentioned earlier, endophytes. So the endophytes are inside the tree leaves, inside the tree needles, and they're protecting the trees from being overeaten by insects. So the fungi are making anti-insect toxins, and that's helping protect the leaves. But there's also parasitic fungi in the forest. They're killing the trees. There are other fungi that are on the bark. There are fungi down in the soil that are eating the dead material that drops off the trees. Most plants, I think it's 80%, something like that, do have some kind of mycorrhizal fungus associated with them. So 8% of land plants don't have mycorrhizae, so it's 92% do have mycorrhizae.
I liked the fungus root on the mycorrhizae. You called it wood wide web, and just to try to understand just what a network and communication that is occurring there.
Yeah, the wood wide web was a term coined by an English mycologist whose name escapes me at the moment, but it was really popularized by Suzanne Simard, who's very well known. Ecologist, forest ecologist from Canada, and so she has done a lot of work on the connection between these mycorrhizal fungi and the plant roots and the whole network that evolves, and so it is a good analogy, I think, to the World Wide Web in that it's a very complex system of connections, and there is some signaling that's moving along. Along the fungal cells and between the plants, and really what the signaling is and how sophisticated it is a matter of maybe some research. They're not disputes, but it's an active area of research now, so it's really not entirely clear what kind of communication is moving, whether it's just sort of I need more phosphorus, send me some, or there's some insects eating that tree next door, maybe we should lock that tree off. Who knows if it's that kind of thing or not, but nevertheless the wiring, if you want to think it that way, is very, very complicated, and it is quite a different view of what an individual is to think that everything is linked together like that. And we as humans, we have no trouble figuring out what our body is, and we don't really link our bodies together into a network like that. So, and that seems to be what the norm is in a forest. So it's a very different thing. Each what looks like an individual tree to us is really a community, and the tree is just the skeleton.
We have much to learn from the forest. Sarah in Chicago wrote in to ask you, are there any mushrooms that mushroom hunters can find in the winter? Sarah is having a hard time thinking that they might have to wait for spring before they can go out again.
Well, you can always go to the grocery store nowadays. I think Pleurotus, the oyster mushroom, I suspect it may grow in the winter sometimes in some places if there's a thaw, but I wouldn't count on it. You know, I wouldn't. I'm just thinking about where it grows up in Canada, and I don't think I've ever seen anything in the winter that I would care to eat. But there is not surprisingly a whole bunch of very specialized fungi that at least they make their spores when it's very cold, but. As far as mushrooms go, I think you'd have to talk to somebody who's used to collecting in the mountains or something. And there may be some snowline fungi that the experts may know about.
One of my favorite moments in your book is your fungal fantasy and piecing together a day where fungi is so centerpiece to our lives. And I'm wondering if you could... you know, just walk us through a little bit of that and where the research is headed on fungi.
Well, there's been a lot of development of kind of what I would call a boutique biotechnology. So small companies and with tens of employees instead of thousands. And they've started using fungal cells to make material for clothing or different kinds of packaging that can be used in place of styrofoam, making building materials out of fungal cells that can then be used very, very much customized in terms of shape and with the idea that all of these things will be biodegradable. And the other advantage to them is that they, compared to using say trees or rock as building material, fungal cells can be grown up in a week or two, and they don't, so it's not as huge an investment in time, and also they use a lot less energy in the long run to produce. So from an environmental perspective, I think these kinds of materials are likely to become quite economically viable. And then there's a lot of more fanciful uses. There's some fungi are bioluminescent, so they emit light, and so there's thoughts they might be able to use them in streetlights and things like that. That's more of a long shot, but the advantage to these boutique biotechnologies is because they're small scale, they can really pick up on individual people's creativity and
scale
kind
it
of.
Up. Yes. Yeah. Keith, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Keith Seifert is an adjunct research professor in the Department of Biology at Carleton University in Ontario. Wrote the book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.